Right, I call the Agriculture, Finance, and Policy Committee to order on February 7th, 2023. There is a quorum present. Representative Purcell, may I have a motion to approve the minutes from February 2nd, 2023?
So moved.
Representative Purcell moves the approval of the minutes for February 2nd, 2023. Any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for February 2nd, 2023 are approved. First item of the agenda today is to talk about the high path avian influenza. And so we invited the College of Veterinary Medicine and African swine flu talk about the issue at hand. If Dr. Marie Kuhain can make your way to the testifying table, and please feel free to identify yourself before the committee, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Chair Vang and committee members, for this opportunity. I'm Dr. Marie Kuhain, food animal veterinarian and professor at the College of Vet Med at the University of Minnesota. I'd like to provide some scientific background on highly pathogenic avian influenza, or HPAI, and African swine fever, ASF, and let you know how the U of M CVM helps Minnesota agriculture and the fight against these two diseases in particular, but also how we work together with Minnesota agriculture in general. And you have the handouts as well. I'm on slide two. In general, Minnesota agriculture is supported by the CVM because it's part of our mission at the college. We're dedicated to improving the health and well-being of animals and strengthening Minnesota's economy. We do this by providing high-quality education, conducting leading-edge research, and delivering innovative veterinary services. I'm on slide three. We're here today because we share the common goals of preventing and controlling devastating diseases like high path AI and ASF. The U of M CVM helps achieve those goals by performing scientific research and providing the veterinary diagnostic services needed to help the state successfully respond to high path AI, prepare for and prevent ASF and many of the other emerging and re-emerging diseases of animals. We educate animal health professionals who are capable of critically thinking through problems and helping farmers, animals, companies, and the public. We continually retrain and provide extension, giving people innovative new skill sets, often just in time or mid-crisis. We hold pre- and post-outbreak tabletop exercises and give after-outbreak reports both online and in-person as courses, seminars, meetings, conferences, and, of course, scientific papers. So let's get into the science. I'm now on slide four. What is highly pathogenic avian influenza, and why do I keep calling it a devastating disease? Well, it's caused by influenza virus, and there are many kinds of influenza viruses. This is a slide with the chicken on it.
And while we try to get situated here, I just want to recognize that today is Poultry Day, and so I want to thank the turkey producers and stakeholders for being here today and in recognition of all the work that you do to support our ag economy. And so thank you so much for being here today. And feel free to, you know, members, feel free to engage with your local producers and the producers that come here. They've made a long commute to be here today. And so just want to recognize that today's Poultry Day. Thank you.
Thank you for the segue. Speaking of poultry, highly pathogenic avian influenza virus is a disease of poultry, and it's devastating, and it's caused by influenza virus. And there's many kinds of influenza viruses in the world in almost every species of animal every day, including humans. But high pathogenic I is what we call the deadly form of the virus in the birds. It infects all organs in the domestic chicken or turkey and causes 100% death loss in just a few days. It's spread by wild birds, some like eagles and loons, that die from high pathogenic I just like the chickens and the turkeys do, but some of which, like ducks and geese, are natural hosts or what we call reservoirs that usually survive the high pathogenic I infections and spread them around the globe. Unfortunately, high pathogenic I is potentially zoonotic, meaning that it can go from the bird to a human. Interestingly, influenza viruses, as shown on the right-hand side of the slide, are actually shared and exchanged between a lot of animal species and humans and birds. So what does high pathogenic I do to an infected chicken or a turkey? What does it look like? Well, they get the flu. They don't eat well. They don't move around. It's hard to breathe. They get high fevers, swollen eyelids, red skin, maybe diarrhea, and even seizures when the virus infects the brain, and then they die. Some die very quickly, and that's because the virus is traveling all through their bodies, infecting every organ, and they will not survive if they are affected with a high pathogenic avian influenza strain. Unfortunately, Minnesota has experience with high pathogenic I. Here's a map from 2014-2015 showing the areas of the United States that had high path. The purple counties are locations of infected commercial flocks and turkeys and chickens. There's a lot of purple in Minnesota in 2014-2015, and the commercial poultry flocks that are so important to Minnesota's agriculture are our focus here today, too. But you should keep in mind that backyard birds and wild birds, all the other colors on the map, also got infected with high pathogenic I and are getting infected with high pathogenic I today. HPI reemerged in 2022 and continues in 2023. Every state in the union, with the exception of Hawaii, has had high pathogenic I virus, and this is indicated by the dots on the map. Again, each color represents a different type of bird or flock. Again, we see that the concentration of dots is heaviest around Minnesota, where we've had commercial poultry, which are dots in red, and backyard flocks and wildlife all getting infected. In fact, many more backyard flocks have been infected with high path this year than ever before, and many more wild birds haven't been infected than ever before. The wild birds are widespread, and this map shows flyways birds use as they move around during migration. Wild birds are widespread, and they're not going away, and they should not go away, and we shouldn't fight them or eradicate wild birds. Instead, we have to learn how to live in this new normal with wild birds, who we know could be bringing high pathogenic I or other viruses to our domestic birds. And that new way of thinking requires us to work together. So more of the science about the HPI outbreaks, where the U of M CVM provides the diagnostics, research, and outreach that's vital to the state to prevent, respond, and control high pathogenic I. For example, let's take a look at 2014-2015 compared to 2022-2023. What did we learn? We had 108 infected farm sites, or what we call premises, in Minnesota. This resulted in 9 million birds that died from infection or were stamped out to prevent the spread. What's currently going on? As of January 18th in Minnesota, we have 110 infected farm sites. And now you're all saying, wait, you didn't learn a thing. You've got two more infected premises or farm sites. Well, let's look more closely at those numbers. Back in 2022-23, we have 79 commercial turkey premises, two commercial chicken premises, but there's 29 backyard flocks. So we went from 107 commercial poultry farm sites down to 81, and half as many birds died or were stamped out in high pathogenic I in 2022-23 compared to 2014-2015. So how did we get to half as many birds involved? Well, we learned that it's very important for a veterinary diagnostic lab to be near the poultry industry to provide rapid detection. And so the Minnesota Poultry Testing Lab in Willmar, a laboratory of the U of M, operates to meet that need. We also learned that if we don't detect infection rapidly, we have delays in removing infected birds. That delay results in farm-to-farm spread. But in 2022-2023, we have less farm-to-farm spread. We have 5 million less birds dying because stamping out or removal of infected birds went really, really well in 2022. And that happened in Minnesota because the industry has been powered to do what they do best, which is to manage their poultry farms and handle their birds, because they know through the research and sharing of information with them that to control the outbreak, removing infected birds has to be done very quickly. But millions of domestic poultry dying and thousands of wild bird dying is not something to brag about. The virus is still causing problems because this outbreak is lasting so long, and that's because the virus has changed. It spreads to more types of birds and animals, and wild bird spread is more efficient in 2022. So we need to continue the research and teaching and outreach about this changing virus. Let's switch over to African swine fever. What is it? Well, it's a disease caused by a virus of pigs and only pigs. So only pigs can be infected with ASF. It's not a new zoonotic disease. It's not a food safety risk. With ASF, 40 to 100% of the pigs die. So ASF infections can indeed cause food supply problems when there's less pork for consumers, and ASF definitely will cause trade problems when borders are closed to countries with ASF. If an ASF-infected pig survives, it never regains full health and production and can even shed the virus from time to time, continually infecting other pigs and contaminating the farm. How quickly the pigs die and how many other pigs they infect prior to dying depends on the strain of the ASF virus they get. But with most strains of the virus, they get fever, they lose their appetite, they lose weight, they won't move, and they die. This sounds a lot like high pathii, doesn't it? Well, ASF is a totally different virus, but ASF also infects every organ in the pig's body. So that's one reason why it reminds us of high path. What's worse about ASF is that it survives, the virus survives for a really long time in the pig meat, in the pig blood, and in the pig environment. So while it's a disease only of pigs, there's many different ways that ASF can find its way into a pig farm. So on the right side of the slide, I'm showing the pathways of ASF infection. One way is in when an infected wild pig comes into contact with our domestic farm pigs. Wild pigs are the hosts, natural hosts of ASF, and like wild ducks and geese, who are the natural hosts of high pathii, some wild pigs seem to be more resistant and spread the disease around, and some wild pigs die from the disease. Another way that ASF gets into pig farms is when the virus is dragged in by people who might have the virus on their boots or clothing, maybe because they came in contact with an infected pig or a domestic pig off-site. This happens because that virus is very hardy. It stays infectious a long time and in the dead pig tissues. If a pig is exposed to a carcass of an infected pig or eats infected pig meat in a discarded ham sandwich, that exposed pig can become infected. So food waste containing pork is another pathway of infection. In warm parts of the world like Africa, the viruses are also moved around by a soft-bodied tick. Thank goodness we don't have that soft-bodied tick in the United States, but we're continually looking out for it. Like high path AI, African swine fever is globally widespread, and it's as close as the Dominican Republic and Haiti. North America remains free of African swine fever virus, and we want to keep it that way. But wild pigs are everywhere, too, and they're widespread, and we're in a constant threat in the United States because African swine fever is moved around by infected wild pigs. What I'm trying to show here is that Minnesota is surrounded by wild pigs with large populations in the southern United States, but also a large population of wild pigs in our neighbors to the north in Saskatchewan and Manitoba. So we have to acknowledge that wild pig populations are a risk. So putting African swine fever and high path AI together again, the goal is to control. And how we do that is to prevent, prepare, and respond, not just in our own farms, but our neighbors, and in that shared ecosystem with wildlife, not just in Minnesota, but with Iowa, South Dakota, and our neighboring states. And later on, you'll hear today about coordinated regional efforts and national efforts to control high path and ASF. We do this through prevention and preparedness, not only in our own country, but in neighboring countries. So we work with Canada to understand that wild pig population problem. We work with Vietnam to understand ASF vaccine usage in their pigs. But people are needed for this response. And we need those people so we can reach those common goals. But they all have different roles during an emergency response. You'll hear more about those goals from and the roles and responsibilities from our colleagues at the Department of Ag and the Board of Animal Health and USDA. But I'll quickly set the stage by showing that one of the roles that's important to play is that by farmers and agricultural systems. They're supposed to keep the virus out. And if the virus gets in, they need to keep it contained. Turkey growers in Minnesota are really good at stamping out the disease when it occurs and controlling things on their farms. So where does the College of Veterinary Medicine fit in all this? Well, we provide the science, like I've tried to do with my talk previously to this, by telling you about HiPath and ASF, but we also provide the support by educating and training a dedicated workforce that's knowledgeable, available, robust, and innovative. We train over 500 professional graduate students to be multitasking, quick thinkers, and problem solvers. We provide those validated diagnostic tests that quickly detect and confirm disease at the two locations, one in the well-supported St. Paul Veterinary Diagnostic Lab and the other in the Poultry Testing Lab in Wilmer. We also provide extension, community education, and outreach and training at all levels to provide the expertise to help with this response. So even though we're not on the front lines, we're providing that expertise when and where it's needed, answering questions like what disinfectants work, how long does this virus survive. The answers we provide can help, and if we don't have the answers, then we work together to do the research. And then after the outbreak, or as needed during outbreaks, we train and retrain, creating more poultry specialists with our poultry certificate program, educating pork producers and swine vets at our Lehman Swine Conference. We share the innovations and research findings so that the next outbreak is less severe, or hopefully, in the case of ASF, prevented completely. We need the research and innovations to help fortify ASF preparedness and prevention plans and to support the ongoing HPI response effort. This includes future research on vaccinations, both of which would be great for both diseases to limit the effects of disease, but they're not available yet. They're coming. And to be successfully at vaccinating, we need vaccines that can be mass applied with minimal additional workforce effort and few adverse effects. We need disease control plans that are scientifically based, and we need to build on our current knowledge of the viruses themselves, of the animals and birds we're trying to protect, and of human nature to make sure that we put in disease control plans that can be carried out by people. We take the research and training and outreach very seriously. We're committed to supporting Minnesota's animal industries and our partners at the Turkey Growers and Pork Board, helping them to take on their new roles in the response. We see our role at the CVM as really facilitating and promoting those public-private partnerships, finding the synergies there, and getting the research findings and innovations into the hands of people that need them. So in conclusion, and I thank you for your patience, I would say that we're really ready for a new reality, even one that requires us to think differently about diseases and includes HiPath AI and the threat of emerging diseases like ASF. And we can be ready here in Minnesota because the U of M CVM is here to provide the research to understand these changing diseases, to educate and train and retrain a workforce, and provide those important services like diagnostic testing and outreach. With that, I'm grateful for your time. I appreciate your service on this committee, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Kuhnhang, for your testimony and for providing that overview for members of the committee and the public today. Any questions from members? Dr. Kuhnhang, I have a question on the research and innovation slide. There's no page number, but is the college working on developing vaccines at the moment?
We're currently collaborating with Vietnam to understand the work there on their vaccine usage, and we are developing tests to differentiate an animal that's been vaccinated from an animal that's been infected. And we support that through research from the United States Department of Agriculture.
All right, thank you. Representative Tapke?
Thank you, Chair Vang. We've got a couple of... I don't know when my microphone's not coming down, sorry. But a couple of things is that first, piggybacking what Chair Vang asked, is if legislation were to happen to help with specifically these two issues, what kinds of things do you think would be best to be done? Is it just money for research? Is there that sort of capability within the U or where we're at right now? Because this is a really big issue. And then I'll hold my second question for next.
Yeah, money for research is helpful. It's surprising how much research costs have gone up, and that when you're dealing with diseases, these high-impact diseases like HPI and ASF, you need different facilities, you need different capabilities. So I can't just go into my regular office and work on these things. I need to have special laboratories, or we need to have connections with other countries. And thankfully or unfortunately, the virus is in the Dominican Republic and Haiti. We could be traveling to those countries to learn about their viruses there. And so it's that increased travel and increased research capacity that would be supported nicely with additional funding. And then it's to continue to have the infrastructure so that not the state doesn't have to continually support the research, but if you have the infrastructure and the connections and you say, yes, I've worked with ASF, here's what I've done, then you can apply for the larger sources of funding from the USDA or the NEFA grants and say, here's my preliminary data that my state helped me determine. Now I'm ready to do big multi-year research. And so it's really a bridge to that sustainable research program. But what we really like to do is respond to the immediate needs of the poultry industry and the pork industry and do things rapidly on farm with them.
Rep. Zimtaki.
Thank you, Chair Vang. And then my second question is specifically for HIPAATH avian influenza. There was a significant amount of outreach and public education kinds of things around that last summer as it pertained to backyard flocks and bird feeders and that type of thing. A lot of it was very conflicting. Like there didn't ever seem to be a single concerted effort for one message to everything. Like some people said it doesn't matter if you do anything, and some people said it did matter. So what is your position on that kind of thing, and what should people know?
Yeah, it's nice to have a common message that it's clear to understand for the public, but we have to understand what a lot of people have different interests, right? So some people certainly we all put the health of humans above everybody else, but then some people would put the health of chickens above the health of eagles. And so there's those conflicting messages there. And so I think if we have a more concentrated effort and that we communicate together, we can get that out. My personal opinions may or may not be right. I did remove my bird feeders, if you're concerned, but I also live on a pond. So I actually have ducks in my yard as well. So, but yeah, we need to have a consistent message. And that I think that'll get better now that the information is out there, and we can continue to build on that.
Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what is the role, if any, of industry consolidation and concentration here? So we're in a very different place than we were 30 or 40 or 50 years ago. The diversity of either the flock or the herd compared to what we have now.
Right. So there's pros and cons to consolidation or integration. One of the pros would be common protocols, more support, more things that are being done the same within a system is what I prefer to call it. The other thing is, when you fall, it hurts. When you're really big and you fall, it hurts a lot. And so we have those large numbers that can go down. However, we, through consolidated agriculture and larger farms, are also more efficient, and we can supply food more cheaply through those big networks as well. So from a disease outpoint, that's the very thing we were talking about, is understanding how the disease moves in those large populations versus the small outdoor populations. Can we protect the indoor animals from wild animals, and we can do that effectively, then can we move people in and out effectively as well? So there's that training that needs to happen. For the smaller farms, having a lot of farms in a lot of different places makes the response more difficult. So if we have to go to one large farm of 10,000 birds versus 10 small farms of 1,000 birds, we've got to spread out our resources that way.
Representative Hansen.
So then as we do concentrate, then it becomes too big to fail. And we have to respond as a state. We have to respond as a legislature to prevent.
I think that's where the partnerships are involved. So if you're too big to fail or too small to break or too big to fail, right? When we are big like this, this is where those public-private partnerships come into place. Because certainly our commercial turkey industry in Minnesota has done a lot to respond and control the problems that they have in their flocks. But they do that as a partnership, and that partnership's been established for decades, building on that. And in some ways, I would say the consolidated turkey industry is much easier to work with than the less consolidated swine industry in the state of Minnesota. We have a lot of players in the swine industry in Minnesota, and getting them all to the table is happening, and you'll hear that later today. But there's so many more differences in the pig farms than there are in the poultry farms in the state. But it's all about a partnership.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doctor, I was reading an article the other night, and it was kind of a worldview on the highly pathogenic bird flu. And the comment that struck me was that we may have to let the disease play itself out. What does that mean, and from somebody in your perspective?
Right. So for me as a virologist, what it means is a successful virus doesn't kill its host. A successful virus makes its host sick enough to spread the virus to everybody else. And so the viruses adapt to become less virulent and then survive. And so the animals will live with high pathii. It actually becomes, the fancy word is attenuated. So it becomes less virulent. So that would be one way that it would work its way out, things like that. And some species will survive that as the virus adapts, and others will be gone forever. So I'm not a fan of that, but I know that we can't control wildlife. I can't predict where they're going to be tomorrow. I can't catch them and vaccinate them and things like that. So what we can do is we can control the things that we can reach, which would be like turkey breeder hens. We could control them and vaccinate them, and we could protect people that are at high risk of getting zoonotic influenza, people that are work in the farms or have compromised immune systems. But that's what it means to let the virus play itself out, see how it goes, see who survives. The virus will win. It'll just be a weaker virus.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. One quick question, kind of following up on Representative Tamke's comment. You know, with eggs being whatever, $5, $6, $7 a dozen, we're hearing a lot of anecdotal stories of folks buying 10 or 15 baby chicks and want to raise their own chickens and get eggs this summer. Could those increase the number of backyard flocks also cause an increase in difficulty in controlling the disease?
There's a lot that the backyard flock owner can do to protect their chickens. And one of them is to just provide a roof over the top so wild birds don't come down upon them. One is to bring them in at night. There's been studies in Australia, in Europe, and here in the United States that show that a lot of the interactions with wildlife occur at night. So if you bring your birds in at night, they're less likely to be exposed. And the other thing is proper sanitation and hygiene. If you're walking around, let's say you're a duck hunter, you go duck hunting, don't, you know, clean your ducks and then go right to feed in your chickens and things like that. And we've laid those out. The U of M College of Extension, our partners, a different college at the University of Minnesota, but one we work closely with, has lots of nice resources for backyard chickens.
All right. Members, we do need to go to our next testifier, so I'll give Representative Chow the final question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is regards to, you mentioned that you're working with a vaccine with Vietnam. Is that a particular reason Vietnam is one of your partner? Are they advanced in this area, or what is?
Yeah, so the United States has had a long relationship with Vietnamese agriculture. And so Mr. Schwartz will talk about this later, is that there's the Swine Health Information Center, which is funded by pork producers with their pork checkoff dollars. And they started the research that said Vietnam, a country that we have strong relationships with, has ASF. They actually have farms that look like our farms in the United States. Let's do research in Vietnam. And so they launched a research campaign to study things in Vietnam. It started in 2019. A lot of it gets shut down because of COVID. We couldn't go there. They couldn't come here. But then the USDA then partnered with Vietnam to market their developed vaccine that they developed at Plum Island. So it's just a result of the long partnerships that have been in place and the fact that their pig population is large enough and there's sites that look like ours that we can learn a lot from them.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Guihang, for your time here.
Thank you.
Next we have is the Minnesota Department of Agriculture to do their presentation. We have Director Lucy Hunt, Executive Director Marianne Garcia from the Board of Animal Health, and Dr. Eric Jope, Assistant Director from the Board of Animal Health. Thank you for being here today. If you can identify yourself before the committee, and you may proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Vang and committee members. My name is Lucia Hunt. I'm the Director of the Office of Emergency Preparedness and Response at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. The Minnesota Ag Incident Management Team, or the IMT, was established back in 2017 as we retooled our response format coming out of the highly pathogenic avian influenza outbreak of 2015. With around 80 members now, our goal is to be available to provide response services for all ag hazards. Situational awareness is the activity of staying abreast of threats. So we are part of the Emergency Preparedness and Response Committee, organized by Homeland Security Emergency Management, where we share important ag updates with our state partners. In our first 5 years on the IMT, we have created a core leadership group. We have hosted several trainings and exercises for skills development and practiced response procedures on the 2022 HPAI incident and also the supply chain disruption to the swine industry back in 2020. Now this image here from USDA gives you an idea of the scale of big responses like this. Foreign animal disease response is probably the most complex organizational structure we'll get into, so no one agency can handle it alone. In a multi-agency response, we use unified command so that each agency has input on the direction of the response is taking. The specialized knowledge, skills, and personnel that agencies bring is combined to better overall results. And in the case of foreign animal disease, our unified command here in Minnesota consists of the USDA, the MDA, and the Board of Animal Health. Now, the board is the lead agency over animal disease control, and the MDA has a broader mission to promote a profitable agricultural industry in Minnesota. An important bridge that we use is the Memorandum of Understanding to keep track of agency roles. Over the years, we have developed an excellent working relationship between our staff and have interactions throughout the year, whether in a response or not, to make sure that our activities are aligned. The MDA provides support to the response in the following ways. We provide training opportunities as well as necessary equipment and supplies to be ready. We are the point of contact for animal emergency reports coming in through the Minnesota Duty Officer. We act with delegated authority to assume management of an incident when requested. And finally, we support public information through our communications team. Now, the Ag Emergency Account was established in 2016 with $1 million. The main benefit we get out of this account is the flexibility to start response actions immediately. And the added preparedness language from last session, the IMT can now invest in high-quality training and is now able to maintain response equipment to meet safety standards and all-season use expectations. On March 25th last year, we got positive results back from two premises here in Minnesota. The board immediately requested assistance from the Ag IMT, and we ordered a national IMT to come and help establish the response in Minnesota. Very quickly, we opened an incident command post in Willmar to set up our personnel and got right to work. Within just a couple of weeks, this body appropriated an additional $1 million to the Ag Emergency Account, which was very, very much appreciated. And again, at the end of your session, we received a second appropriation of $1.5 million to carry us through. I want to walk you through the major expenses that we've incurred over the last year on the HPAI incident. And keep in mind that these numbers stretch across two fiscal years and are subject to shift as transactions are still ongoing. The first expense category is payroll. Over 60 MDA employees participated in the event, putting 10,000 hours toward the work. Our cooperative agreement with USDA allows all overtime charges to be reimbursed. The next category is the incident command post. We contracted with Kandi Ojai County for the use of their emergency operations center in Willmar. This central location allowed our teams to be close to the major turkey growing region, to the Minnesota poultry testing lab, and to industry headquarters. Our team secured a different facility in Willmar in August and relocated there just in time for the fall resurgence of HPAI. Now, this lease is ongoing through July 31st to cover what we expect to be another busy spring in 2023. We'll be spending a total of just under $100,000 on our incident command post. Next category is contract services. The major activities our contractors perform for us are for depopulation assignments. They generate and apply foam to the flocks. And they also set up decontamination lines at the infected sites to make sure that people, equipment, and vehicles are not tracking infectious material off the farms with them. And a portion of these expenses for our contractors are eligible for reimbursement through Minnesota's cooperative agreement with USDA, but the total you see here is the upfront costs we've paid out prior to requesting reimbursement. Next comes Minnesota IT services. The Minute Team provides the hardware, networking, and internet capabilities that give responders seamless interface to collaborate with field staff, the labs, and colleagues working remotely. The top-notch mapping specialists at Minute create excellent GIS products for incident responders. And our last category here is supplies and equipment. An item that tops this list is firefighting foam. Now, the federal response will send out foam to states, but they get stretched really thin in a widespread incident like this, and our home stockpile ensures that we can handle very large farms or multiple cases in quick succession. And another item in this category is payment to the Minnesota Poultry Testing Lab to cover the cost of HPAI tests that are not covered by federal reimbursement. So this summary of HPAI expenditures shows both the state and federal money spent in Minnesota. The HPAI incident has spent $1.8 million over the last 11 months of the response, leaving us with $2.3 million in our Ag Emergency Account. And the cooperative agreement with USDA is worth $1.7 million. We've been able to use about half that amount in 2022, leaving us about $750,000 through September of 2023. The University of Minnesota's Veterinary Diagnostic Lab is a critical partner in the HPAI response. Last session's appropriation of $1.5 million is now available to the U to purchase equipment that will ensure they meet their goals of rapid and accurate disease reporting, and it will also improve their diagnostic capabilities for other foreign animal diseases. Since about 2019, the MDA has been involved in preparing for a swine disease outbreak. We started off by planning, hosting, and participating in a multi-state exercise called Swine Fever Exercise for Agricultural Response, or SFEAR, which was offered by USDA. Working through Minnesota's Swine Emergency Disease Management Committee, the MDA has helped close some knowledge and skills gaps identified by that exercise. We've mostly focused on depopulation and disposal issues. The first of those depop and disposal projects was back in February of 2020, when we had a project testing whether animal carcasses could be successfully composted in a Minnesota winter. We were successful. So built on that, the following winter in 2021, we used some federal grant money to fine-tune the winter composting procedures and to test capabilities of a new depopulation method using carbon dioxide that was developed by our industry partners. And finally, the MDA coordinated a federal grant project that just finished up last year. This one involved the field trial of a novel mass depopulation system using nitrogen to put swine down quickly and humanely under Minnesota's environmental conditions. And our next step is to repeat some of those sphere modules to test ourselves and find other gaps to explore. Chair Vang and committee members, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Director Hunt. Members will take questions after we hear from our next two testifier. Executive Director Garcia, you may proceed. Please identify yourself before the committee.
Thank you, Chair Vang and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Eric Jopp, the Assistant Director of the Board of Animal Health. Highly pathogenic avian influenza is an international disease affecting most areas of the world. It was diagnosed in the U.S. in the spring of 2022 and has spread throughout the country. The national statistics change every week, and as of Sunday, there were 47 affected states and 748 confirmed premises, both commercial and backyard flocks. West Virginia, Louisiana, and Hawaii are the states that have not had domestic poultry diagnosed as of yet. The slide in front of you illustrates the new cases of high-path AI across the country by week for the past year. As we've heard already, the last outbreak in the U.S. of high-path AI occurred in 2015 when it affected 21 states and 232 flocks. Here in Minnesota, we had our first case in late March of 2022 and our most recent case in early December. This slide also represents case distribution by week for the Minnesota cases. Most cases during the current outbreak have been in the upper Midwest. Minnesota has had the highest number of affected flocks of any state, mostly commercial turkeys, as Minnesota is the number one turkey-producing state in the nation. Although most of Minnesota's 110 cases have been in the poultry-dense areas of the state, it is important to note that this outbreak has affected 38 counties, including the Twin Cities metro area. The pictures on this slide show the rapid onset of disease that can typically be seen. Within hours, a flock can go from normal to quiet, depressed, and dying. Our response efforts have been based on our written plan and lesson learned from the 2015 outbreak. This slide shows the sequence of events that occur once a flock becomes ill and samples are tested in the lab. State resources are directly involved in all of the activities that are in bold. There are activities which take place on the affected premise, activities which take place in the lab, and documentation requirements throughout. The board is the lead agency for the state, working on a unified command construct with the USDA, with resources and expertise coming from many agencies, including the Minnesota Department of Ag, for logistics, finance, personnel, and resources, Minnesota Department of Health for responder and grower health monitoring, University of Minnesota Laboratories and Extension, and additional personnel from the USDA Wildlife Services, Minnesota Veterinary Medical Reserve Corps, county emergency managers, as well as many others. Minnesota has taken several steps to help us respond effectively while also keeping commodities moving throughout the state. The legislature provided emergency funding as the need arose and several executive orders lifting restrictions for hours of service for drivers of commercial motor vehicles, providing direct assistance to the emergency relief efforts.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Dr. Marion Garcia, Executive Director for the Board of Animal Health. We are currently working with accredited poultry veterinarians to minimize the impact of this virus, but the number of tools available to us is limited. As we look towards the spring and the potential for continued cases of high-path AI, we are working to streamline our efforts and decrease the strain on resources and the strain on people. This is in line with evolution that USDA is taking in their documentation requirements and response guidance. For example, non-poultry backyard flock surveillance guidance, streamlining some of the documentation required, and a pilot project on the indemnity process. Our guiding principle as we go into the spring is to increase the number of personnel who have expertise in the various response steps. We have sent personnel to train on the computer software used in emergency response. We have more personnel lined up to go to case manager training, and we are bringing in a carcass disposal training event. We are also coordinating closely with the industry and the industry veterinarians. This will help us be able to pivot should we need to respond to another disease emergency, such as African swine fever. African swine fever is a devastating virus that is not far from the borders of the United States, as it is currently in Haiti and the Dominican Republic. In 2019, Minnesota participated in the USDA swine fever exercise for agriculture response. As a result of this exercise, we worked with the University of Minnesota to develop a written response plan based on the USDA Red Book. We have created communication templates, and we have implemented a swine-focused emergency response committee to fine-tune our plan and create a venue for collaboration. The plan is based on the national plan, which calls for an immediate 72-hour stop movement of pigs throughout the state and the nation. Our focus is how will we maximize use of these 72 hours to either identify potential risks or be able to provide assurance of freedom of disease and the ability to manage risk. Through the U.S. Swine Health Improvement Plan, or U.S. SHIP, we are validating premise ID numbers, and we are collaborating with industry to validate our ability to conduct tracebacks. As with high-path AI, the method of dealing with an outbreak of African swine fever will be depopulation and disposal of positive herds. No vaccines or treatments are available. With our partners at the Minnesota Department of Ag, Minnesota has done several depopulation and disposal exercises. We are in the process of setting up a composting course that will include the poultry and the swine industry. Thank you for your time and attention to this important issue, and we'd be happy to take questions collectively.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? All right. Well, we can thank you so much, Executive Director and Director Hunt, for being here today and for providing your testimony. Next we have is testimony from USDA, Stephen Schaefer. Who is the area veterinarian in charge. If you can please make your way to the testifying table, identify yourself before the committee, and you may proceed. Thank you for being here today.
Good afternoon, Chair Vang and committee members. Thank you so much for your invitation to discuss USDA activities related to African swine fever and high-path AI. I'm Dr. Stefan Schaefbauer, area veterinarian in charge for USDA Animal Plant and Health Inspection Service, Veterinary Services here in Minnesota. As my state partners and the university has already shared, to date, USDA's National Veterinary Services Laboratory has confirmed the presence of HPI in commercial and backyard flocks in 47 states, resulting in 748 confirmed flocks and 58.2 million birds affected. USDA is collaborating with our state partners on this response. We provide people resources, policy recommendations, as well as funding. Since December 31st, 2022, USDA committed nearly $115 million to support Minnesota's response. Broken down, that was $93 million in indemnity, and that's payments to producers for birds that were depopulated, $16.9 million for depopulation, disposal, and virus elimination activities, $3.2 million in contracts and agreements, and $1.6 million for support of personnel and associated field costs. In comparison, USDA paid $67 million in indemnity during the 2015 response, and those numbers are specific for Minnesota. I really focused on sharing the numbers for the funding because I knew my state partners would share a lot of the activities that we've done. And so I don't, you know, every activity that we work side by side with our state partners on this response, and so I didn't really add any additional slides related to that. I want to switch over to African swine fever. Here are the demographics for swine across the country. And so our domestic swine concentrated in the Midwest, some in the Southeast, feral swine in the southern portion of the U.S., and then zoos distributed pretty evenly across the country. That ends up being 74 million hogs and pigs domestically. We have 7 million feral swine and about 205 suitids in zoos. USDA works hard to protect our swine industry. Our swine industry exports 25% of their production, and so our African swine fever outbreak would cut those exports off, and it threatens the $150 billion global pig industry. USDA is really focused on protecting our national herd through prevention, response, outreach, and planning. One way USDA responded was by creating a protection zone for Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. The protection zone prohibits movement of live swine and swine germplasm, swine products and byproducts from those territories onto the mainland U.S. Another important prevention strategy in Puerto Rico is the monitoring of illegal boat landings. These inspections address the potential introduction of animal and animal byproducts to ensure that they're not fed to domestic pigs in Puerto Rico. One thing I wanted to mention and point out on this slide is that if there's an illegal boat landing and there's swine or swine products on the boat, there's a 3 kilometer a 3 kilometer surveillance zone placed around that landing, and weekly inspections are done on swine farms in that area, including sampling surveillance. Additional strategies include both internal and external barriers to entry. Internal to the U.S., We have garbage feeding restrictions under the Swine Health Protection Act. We also monitor ethnic markets for illegal swine products. And also, it's a way for us to find if there's additional garbage feeders that pick up food waste from these markets. External to the U.S., we have restrictions on international garbage and restrictions on live swine and swine products. We also partner with Customs and Border Patrol for passenger screening and confiscation of animal products. Lastly, I want to talk about our three-prong approach to monitoring. USDA has a swine hemorrhagic disease targeted surveillance program. This program has multiple streams for testing. One of our most important streams is sick pigs submitted to diagnostic labs. Usually these samples are submitted for something else, but if they meet the criteria, the samples can automatically be tested for classical swine fever and African swine fever with no charge to the producers. We also test pigs condemned at slaughter plants that meet the criteria, along with sick or dead pigs at livestock markets or buying stations. Lastly, our smaller streams are swine in high-risk herds, feral swine, or swine tested as part of foreign animal disease investigations. Since fiscal year 19, the USDA has tested close to 80,000 samples for African swine fever and classical swine fever. On this chart, I'd like to point out a few of our testing streams. One being the orange bar, which is pretty steady at the bottom. Those are foreign animal disease investigations. And so those have been steady throughout the years. Our accredited veterinarians haven't been seeing any more strange activity to call out our foreign animal disease diagnosticians, which are both state and federal veterinarians. The stream, though, that is the most important stream is from our diagnostic labs, because they're have veterinarians who submit samples from sick pigs. You see in FY21, there was a sharp incline in that sample set, and that's because USDA changed the policy that those samples had to have premises ID numbers associated with them. In doing that, we have more access to more different types of samples. And so the labs have been able to test more. And then the red line feral swine testing, it kind of goes up and down because there's a seasonality to that testing, because it's usually associated with hunter harvested samples. Thank you so much, Madam Chair. I'll take questions.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Back to the hypatia avian influenza and the culling of the birds. What has USDA done to ensure that the foam does not include PFAS or PFOS in terms of its recommendations on how do we kill the birds?
Yes, thank you for that question. We, in our stockpile, we don't have any foam that has the PFAS. And then our state partners can speak to, they do source some of their foam from USDA, I'm not familiar with that issue.
Representative Hansen?
I think the state is going to answer from the state.
Okay. Director Hunt, please identify yourself before the committee and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Hansen. The PFAS question has been quite ongoing with the foam. The foam that we use for the turkey depopulations is considered what they call Class A foam. It's low expansion foam, and none of the Class A foams are manufactured or contain PFOS products. It's the Class B foams that we are more concerned about. So the federal stockpile and state stockpile are free of those materials.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you. And then a question on the feral hogs, and you know, in Minnesota we have some hogs that have gone wild, so they're not the Eurasian boar, but pigs that have got loose and have, and I think we've been unsuccessful in eradicating them. So how do we deal, you know, I know in the South we have wild boar that's got loose, but how do we deal with essentially released pigs or pigs that have got out and are going wild?
I will do my best speaking to this. It's not, so USDA, when it comes to feral pigs, our wildlife services agency deals with that. And I don't want to overspeak on behalf of the Board of Animal Health. I will say Minnesota does not have any established breeding populations. So when that's why you don't see Minnesota listed on the map. I don't know if it might be more appropriate for Dr. Garcia to speak to the feral pig, or not feral pigs, because we don't have those, but wild pigs or loose pigs.
Madam Chair, committee members, Dr. Garcia again, Board of Animal Health. So occasionally it is true that some pigs may become loose. We have a cooperative working relationship with the Department of Natural Resources and local law enforcement. So when we get a notification that a pig has somehow gotten loose, usually it's a backyard producer, not a commercial producer, then we will work closely with local law enforcement to have those animals taken care of.
Representative Hansen.
It's my understanding we have some loose now that have been loose for a while. And with the presentation, the fear would be that they become a reservoir for disease. Because you'd have the contact potentially with people or in the environment where if African swine fever did get established there, then that could be a pretty strong vector if they're running wild. So I think we've raised before, I think we need to raise again, dealing with this three agency resolution. Happy to work with the other side of the aisle on this. I'm concerned about that impact.
Dr. Garcia, response?
Understand your concern, Representative Hansen. As you said, there are several agencies involved in this, and we will absolutely continue to work towards a resolution.
All right. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for Dr. Schaefbauer. And this is just a hypothetical. If a single case of African swine fever were discovered somewhere in this country, would that put a total ban on our export of pork?
Thank you for that question. With most of our disease responses, USDA works really hard to prove through, so initially through our policy and our work with our trading partners, with most of our diseases, we're able to do what we call regionalization. And so with the poultry industry, we've worked really hard over the years to prove to our trading partners that we're able to regionalize, compartmentalize diseases related to poultry. I am not familiar with our goal would be to regionalize so that all trade isn't cut off, but also the way we move our pigs in this country is very different than how we move our poultry. And so I apologize. I don't have a good answer for you. I can speculate that all trade would be cut off, but I could not say that on behalf of USDA because I haven't seen a policy related to that.
Representative Anderson.
I think we have time. One more question.
Yes.
Thank you. This one would go back to the bird flu. You know, becoming more prevalent and kind of a year-round situation, if it were deemed to be an endemic situation, would that impact the USDA indemnification of farmers that lose their flocks?
That's a really good question. As of now, our Code of Federal Regulations states that we would, any flocks that are depopulated by the USDA, we would provide fair market value in the form of indemnity for those birds. We have not looked at policy related to the disease being endemic and depopulation not occurring.
All right. Any further question? Final question from members? All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Shape. Representative Nelson?
I'm wondering, we got Commissioner Peterson here, and I'm wondering if he could clarify what the rule for catching wild pigs in St. Paul is.
Thank you for the question, Representative Nelson. Well, thank you, Stefan, here today and testifying on behalf of USDA.
Thank you.
Next, we have testifiers from the poultry industry. Jess Westbrock, president from the Minnesota Turkey Growers Association. If you can make your way to the testifying table and identify yourself before the committee. Thank you for being here today. And also we have Dr. Michelle Crome as well.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Jessica Westbrock, and I am a third-generation turkey farmer from the Melrose, Minnesota area. In addition to growing turkeys with my family in Stearns County, we also have a bedding company. We run a feed mill, and we process approximately 1.6 million turkeys a year through our family business, and we process in Marshall, Minnesota. I also currently serve as the president of the Minnesota Turkey Growers Association. As I'm sure you are all aware, Minnesota ranks first in the nation for turkey production, with roughly 670 turkey farms throughout the state. Minnesota's turkey industry is proud of its multi-generation farming families, innovative processing sector, and expansive supporting industries. In addition to Minnesota being the nation's leader in overall turkey production, our state also has more independent turkey growers than any other state in the nation, as well as three turkey processing companies, Genio Turkey Store in Wilmer, Northern Pride in Thief River Falls, and Turkey Valley Farms, a farmer co-op in Marshall, Minnesota. Our industry takes pride in the positive impact we make, not only in the rural communities where we grow turkeys, but the positive impact we make within the state of Minnesota as a whole. Few facts. Minnesota's turkey industry creates 46,000 jobs, creating $12 billion economic impact on the state. Specifically, each turkey produced creates $24.32 worth of economic stimulus within the state. Now, for the not-so-fun part. Others testifying today discussed the overall impact of high-path avian influenza, or HPAI, on Minnesota, but I'd like to share a personal narrative about my family's direct experience with the disease. In 2015, our family had flocks test positive for HPAI on four of our largest farms. We have nine in Stearns County. We lost 180,000 birds. During this period, our feed business also went to 30% of its normal volume. When we told the feed mill workers we'd be very slow, they all volunteered to help with the high path cleanup. The workers on the healthy farms continued to raise birds, and the rest of us worked on the cleanup and virus elimination. With everyone working together, we were able to keep spirits up. And my dad, who's my boss, has a strong faith and would always say, if you're worried, pray, and if you pray, why worry? In 2022, our family had flocks test positive in early April and lost 94,500 birds on two farms. I found my experience in 2022 to be much smoother and more efficient than in 2015. I think as a whole, we learned a lot, in part due to my experience and in part due to the process just being better all around. Many people spend a lot of time and energy advocating and changing policies, for the boots on the ground to streamline response, and we are very thankful for that. While the permitting process to move birds in and out of control zones is still very burdensome for the farmer, especially when we have sick animals we want to tend to, the whole process was better communicated and executed in 2022. Time will tell if 2023 will be a repeat. Thank you very much for your time. We'll answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate you being here today. Dr. Michelle, please identify before the committee and you may proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Vang. Committee members, thank you very much for the time on behalf of the Minnesota Turkey Growers Association. My name is Michelle Kram. I'm a board-certified poultry veterinarian with master's in public health and avian medicine. I started my career in 2007 and served as a staff veterinarian for Genio Turkey Store for a number of years, eventually becoming vice president of animal health and welfare for Genio Turkey Store as well as Hormel Foods. And I left just over a year ago. And unfortunately for the Turkey Growers Association, they provided a nice landing spot for me, and I currently serve as a scientific affairs advisor for MTGA. Last spring, however, our association was operating without an executive director. And so in the face of what was starting to look like a repeat of the highly pathogenic avian influenza outbreak from 2015, I was asked to help support the organization. In my role, my job was primarily to facilitate the flow of communication from the industry to the incident command group, both led by Lucy Hunt and others throughout the outbreak. As you've heard from previous testimony given by our partners, we are very fortunate to have collaboration across agencies, the Department of Ag, the Board of Animal Health, the Minnesota Department of Health, between state and federal responders, as testament to Dr. Schaefbauer being here today. But for our members, most importantly, between industry and response agencies overall. During the course of the outbreak, our industry veterinarians, including myself, met with incident command members routinely as a response required. This was anywhere from 3 times a week down to 1 a week. And it was during these meetings that response priorities were set, feedback regarding critical response activities was given, composting-related issues, depopulation-related issues, as well as communication needs that were identified to ensure the right stakeholders had the right information at the right time. When individual farms become positive, it's not only highly impactful for that farm, as Jess has mentioned, but there's also implications for the larger neighborhood, as well as international trade implications. To reduce the risk for additional spread occurring in the neighborhood, several measures are typically put into place, as restricting the movement of birds and bird-associated materials, additional biosecurity steps in the form of auditing, as Jess had mentioned in her comments, as well as a lot of additional testing to try to catch any additional cases sooner rather than later. Once the positive farm completes its initial round of cleaning, then there's a whole process to release that zone, which also requires a large amount of communication. We've made agreements with our trade partners to do a certain amount of testing in a certain amount of time on a certain amount of farms. And for all of that to be coordinated in an efficient manner requires a tremendous amount of time, human capital, and a lot of communications. Just as a side note, even in the face of the events of 2022, Minnesota still exported over $114 million in turkey products. So keep that in mind that we didn't have export market access for the majority of 2002 because of the events in the spring. So all the stakeholders are well aware of the economic impacts and all come around the table to really make sure that when it comes especially to trade that we can get all that testing aligned to release those zones as soon as we safely can. And Dr. Colheen did touch on some of the dynamics and generalities of influenza, and I apologize, you're gonna hear a couple things that I do think are pretty critical to hear again going into the spring of 2023 that make this virus, which has become a very much an ongoing outbreak, different than what we experienced in 2015. So as Marie mentioned in her comments, this virus is very widespread in wild birds. And just to kind of frame that up, what very means, in 2015, that virus was detected in around 100 times in wild birds. And again, this isn't an apples-to-apples comparison because, yes, surveillance systems have changed over time. But in this outbreak ongoing, we've had detections in over 2,000 species of birds. So when you think about wild birds being the source of spillover events for domestic poultry, you can kind of understand why we're very concerned that we're in for another tough spring. You've already heard several times that the scope of the outbreaks were very different. Again, about 21 states were impacted in 2015, 47 with this ongoing outbreak we're experiencing now. Also, we've had some spillover events into mammals. So in this case, with this virus, we've had bobcats, raccoons, possums, a wide variety of basically animals that tend to scavenge off of dead carcasses be impacted. So I just share those things not to be a Debbie Downer towards the end of the committee hearing, but just to frame up what the new reality is, not just for our industry, but also for our regulatory agencies that most likely are going to have to answer a call that potentially is coming this spring. So while the outbreak started in 2022, brought many new challenges for Minnesota's turkey producers, again, we are very grateful to have the support of MDA, the Board of Animal Health, MDH, the Poultry Testing Lab, and the Veterinary Diagnostic Lab, and we're tremendously appreciative of all the hard work of those folks as they supported us in 2022, and to appreciate all the funding to make that happen from the committee. Thank you, and we'll take some questions if you have any.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? All right. Well, thank you so much, President Westbrook and Dr. Michelle, for being here today and for providing us very sobering testimony for us. Thank you. Next, we have, do we have any further testifiers from the poultry industry? Okay. Well, next, our final testifier is from the pork industry. Mark Schwartz from the Schwartz Farm, if you can make your way through the testifying table, and please identify yourself before the committee. Thank you for being here today.
Good afternoon, Chair Bang and committee members. My name is Mark Schwartz, and I am a pig farmer from Sleepy Eye, Minnesota. It's an honor to be here today to provide some background information on what pig farmers are doing for preparedness and response plans for foreign animal diseases, specifically African swine fever, or ASF. To understand the risks associated with ASF, it may be helpful to understand Minnesota's place in pig farming and pork production. There are more than 3,000 family pig farms in Minnesota, and as a state, we raise and market about 16 to 17 million pigs annually. Minnesota is the second largest pork-producing state in the U.S., and as an industry, we employ more than 20,000 people, both on farms and in supporting and associated industries, including feed manufacturing, delivery, pig transport, and processing. The pork industry is diverse in the types of production practices, its scale, and the markets to which our pigs are supplied. However, a foreign animal disease such as ASF would have far-reaching impacts on the farmers, the employees, the families, the communities, and would be felt indiscriminately, whether a pig farm raised 3,000 or 300,000 pigs. Pig farmers are acutely aware of the serious and imminent threat of an ASF outbreak. For the first time since 1982, ASF is in the Western Hemisphere in the Dominican Republic and Haiti, less than 1,000 miles from the continental United States. As you've heard from Drs. Culhane and Schaefbauer, there are multiple transmission pathways that could introduce ASF into the U.S., including wild boar population, wild pig populations, contaminated feed ingredients, contaminated food waste, and multiple human pathways, all worthy of our consideration and investment in prevention, protection, and detection. There has been and continues to be substantial investment, coordination, and cooperation among farmers, animal health officials, supporting industries, veterinarians, the state and federal government agencies, and international agencies to develop preparedness and response plans for disease outbreaks. With direct producer investment through the National Pork Board, the Swine Health Information Center, which was founded in 2015, directs and coordinates global health disease monitoring programs, targeted research of testing methods, and response strategies, including rapid response plans that aim to better prepare and respond to known or emerging swine diseases. The U.S. Swine Health Improvement Plan, inaugurated in August of 2021, is a coordinated partnership between pig farmers, the state, and federal governments. Through the U.S. Swine Health Improvement Plan, producers, state animal health organizations, and the USDA are working together to enhance biosecurity standards and establish standardized, coordinated means of traceability and surveillance. All production types and scales of producer are represented and collaborating on national plans focusing on those three legs of the program: biosecurity, traceability, and surveillance. Biosecurity is not a new concept to pig farms or pig farmers. We take great pride and care to protect our animals from possible exposure to disease-causing pathogens through practices including washing and disinfecting transport trailers that move the pigs from site to site and to market, showering before entering the breeding herd facilities and showering back out, having dedicated clothing at the production facilities, having required downtime between visits from among populations of pigs, and implementing holding times for supplies and products entering into the farms. And in the last 10 to 15 years, filtering of the air, incoming air into the breeding herds to reduce the incidence of aerosol transmission of a virus. While biosecurity practices require additional facilities such as truck washes and filtration systems and employee training and compliance and oversight, this adds cost and complexity to raising a pig. But we know it's foundational in the step in preserving the health of our animals. Traceability is another key step as we think about how we will respond to an outbreak. Pig farming creates a complex web of connection points among the breeding herds, the nurseries and finishing barns, and points of sale. Technologies such as AgView, which provides pig movement data to state and federal officials in the event of a foreign animal disease outbreak, was developed under the direction of the National Pork Board and again funded directly by producers. However, there's still opportunity to better enable end-to-end traceability of pigs as they move between farms, markets, and eventually into pork products and retail and food service. Traceability will be especially important because of the interconnectedness of Minnesota's pork industry with our neighboring states and Canadian provinces. A well-coordinated and effective means of communication among these state and federal agencies regarding animal and product movements will be essential to quickly gain an understanding of the scope and reach of the outbreak. Disease surveillance at multiple levels is also critical. As you've heard from previous comments, ASF is a very stable virus, and the nature of latent and incubation periods of ASF-infected pigs make early and accurate detection essential to an effective response. The work directed by and funded through the Swine Health Information Center, as well as the formation of the U.S. Swine Health Improvement Plan, along with the efforts of the state animal health organizations, the land-grant universities, and the USDA, continue to develop further testing options and surveillance mechanisms that will allow the industry to respond quickly and effectively in the event of an outbreak. If or when ASF is detected in the U.S., farmers and consumers alike would quickly feel the effect. There would likely be substantial supply chain disruptions as we work to contain and stamp out the disease. This would create considerable uncertainty in the domestic marketplace, and if ASF were detected in the U.S., our ability to export pork would be shut down immediately. The U.S. exports between 25 and 30% of our production annually, and without those markets, the value of our pigs would drop dramatically. Dr. Dermot Hayes, an economist at Iowa State University, has done extensive analyses to quantify the economic impact of an ASF outbreak. His 2020 study showed that a hypothetical outbreak of ASF would cost the U.S. industry more than $50 billion over the first 10 years. In addition, the ripple effect of an outbreak of ASF and the lost value of other products, such as corn and soybeans produced by those producers, milk, beef, and poultry, would be devastating to those ag sectors as well. If there were to be a foreign animal disease outbreak, we know that the social, emotional, and economic toll on our people, our employees, our families, our communities would be significant. I witnessed firsthand during the COVID-19 plant closures in April, May, June of 20, and the effect on the employees and our communities. As difficult as that time was for all, with the uncertainty and the inability to know if or when things would get back to normal in marketing and moving of our animals, an ASF outbreak and its impact on the farmers, the employees, the communities, that would make the events of the spring of 2020 pale in comparison. Due to the gravity of a potential ASF outbreak, I'm sure you as committee members can understand why we have continued to ask for your support for critical response strategies at the state level. Those include recent investments in technology, facilities, and the people at the University of Minnesota's Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory. Replenishing funds for the Agriculture Emergency Fund and additional funding for disease preparedness and response planning at the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. Furthermore, coordination and convening done by a highly capable and responsive state veterinarian and Board of Animal Health is and will be essential to an effective animal disease response. African swine fever is a clear and present danger to the health of the North American swine herd. Farmers and the government agencies must remain vigilant while we continue to prepare our farms and our people for a potential outbreak situation. We've seen the devastating impact of ASF and what that can do in countries where they do not have proper plans and tools in place. It takes coordination and cooperation by many parties, and we as pig farmers will continue to engage and lead in this area, as it is in the best interests of our animals, our people, our communities, and our food system. Thank you for your time and your kind attention. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? All right. Well, thank you so much, Mark, for being here today and for your testimony. It is really important to hear these testimonies. It is an important issue for us at the state, and I look forward to continuing that partnership with all the stakeholders and industry experts. And with that, that is our final item of the day for today's committee. Thank you again to all the producers and testifiers for being here today and making the commute to be with us here at the Capitol. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.